Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this April 5, 2022 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Counsel, we are, as you know, participating by Zoom interactive video, but we're only making an audio recording of the proceedings today. So please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's attached to which argument. The first case we have on for oral argument today is State of Minnesota versus Juno. You can correct me if I've mispronounced the name. Each of you have your argument with an additional, or 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel for rebuttal, if you'd like to use that time. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Nelson. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, John Edward Juno. Today, I would like to focus this court's attention on Mr. Juno's Fourth Amendment arguments. There are two. First, law enforcement unlawfully ordered a canine sniff search of the exterior of Mr. Juno's vehicle without reasonable suspicion. And second, law enforcement allowed that dog to search the inside of his car without probable cause. Because both of these actions violated Mr. Juno's Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches, he asked this court to suppress the methamphetamine in his car and reverse his conviction. I'd like to begin with the reasonable suspicion argument.
Can I take you off track just for a bit?
Yes, Your Honor.
A couple of questions, and it goes to forfeiture. So I'd like you to talk about the entry first rather than the reasonable suspicion first, if you don't mind. I just have a few questions about it. But also, am I correct in your reply brief that you are abandoning one of your arguments? You're recognizing that one of your arguments is forfeited, but your position is the entry without probable cause part of your opening brief is not forfeited. Am I correct?
That's correct, Judge Ross. The third Fourth Amendment argument challenging the dog's reliability based on training, it does not fit the same waiver exception that the entry issue does.
Right. Okay. That's important because the dog never had an opportunity to provide testimony.
That's correct.
So speaking of providing testimony on the forfeiture question, your position is that there's all the facts are undisputed, but the concern that I have, and you can address this if you could, I'm wondering if the issue had been teed up, whether the dog's handler might have had the opportunity to explain either that the dog indeed alerted, but the focus was on the alerting on the console, because that was the issue that was raised. But there's no need to address whether the dog alerted in the walk around the car. And I suppose, and I'm just, I don't know, but I'm wondering whether it's not, wouldn't be unreasonable for a handler to say, once the dog is no longer being restrained by the handler and the dog on its own goes into the car without direction, the handler might have had the opportunity to testify that that in and of itself would indicate that the dog recognized that there was drugs inside the car, establishing probable cause. So my question just goes to your argument that there's no plausible other facts that could have been considered for the question as to forfeiture.
Your Honor, I take your point that the canine handler in this case didn't testify. The only testifier we had was Sergeant Blair. But the canine handler's testimony, in a way, did come in two different ways. So the first way it came in was Sergeant Blair testified that he talked to the canine handler. And what the canine handler told him is that the dog alerted inside of the vehicle on the center console. And then the second form of testimony we have is we do have the video. And in the video, the canine handler can be heard coming back to the car where Juno is restrained. And he tells Juno that the dog alerted inside of the car on the center console. So there is no discussion about any kind of alert on the outside of the vehicle. And
well,
the video
does the discussion that the dog alerted inside the vehicle foreclose, is it logically foreclose the possibility that if the issue had been teed up, the handler might have said that the dog also alerted or acted in a manner that would indicate an interest or an awareness of drugs inside the car before the dog entered the car. Is that not plausible in your view?
It does not logically foreclose that, but my argument is that the canine handler or Sergeant Blair would have had an interest in testifying that there was an alert on the outside, because an alert on the outside would have arguably given them probable cause to search the inside. So there would be no benefit in the canine handler or Sergeant Blair only testifying there was an alert inside the car.
Unless it's not an issue. Unless it wasn't raised as an issue and there's no need to venture into it.
Well, Your Honor, what I would point to then is I would discuss the Watson factors here. And so the four factors this court is looking at to see if this issue is even properly before this court and properly considered are, is it a novel issue? Was it raised prominently in briefing? Third, was it closely akin to the arguments below? And then the fourth factor is really what you're referring to. And that's, is this dependent on any new or controverted facts?
Yes.
And again, I take your point that this wasn't teed up. The canine handler wasn't called, and so he didn't have the opportunity to testify about other things that occurred. But when we talk about the video, both the state and I have watched it, and we both summarize the video the same way. I don't think I can sufficiently answer that question about what the canine handler could have testified about, because I would just be speculating.
Mr. Nelson, I got a few questions to following up on your recent answers. I guess, why would we apply Watson instead of, Watson is a civil case. It seems that in criminal cases, the Supreme Court has applied other case law concerning forfeiture, such as Sorensen, more recent case, Rasmussen, an older case. Why do you point us to Watson instead of those criminal cases?
Your Honor, I don't have the case directly in front of me, but I did cite a case in my brief where this court in a criminal case did apply Watson. I think this court came to the conclusion that they didn't want to review the issue because the factors weren't met. So it is distinguishable on that ground. But this court has applied Watson to a criminal case.
Yeah, on one, I think on one occasion only. But it seems like predominantly the Supreme Court applies other cases other than Watson. Going back to the factual record, you said that, I mean, isn't it true that Officer Blair learned from what the handler told Officer Blair was not inside, but rather that the dog alerted especially on the center console, right?
The actual quote, if you just give me one moment, Your Honor. Sergeant Blair's testimony was that the canine handler for the city of Blaine informed me that there was a positive indication on the vehicle for narcotics, and he specifically mentioned the center console area.
So that by itself does not state that the dog was inside the car versus outside the car. I mean, I understand it. It might be. I'm not sure whether a dog could pick out a place while outside the car, but I'm not sure that a dog couldn't either, or at least, you know, the handler might have been making a distinction between the passenger compartment and the trunk or something. But my second question is the video was not introduced during the suppression hearing, I'm pretty sure, and therefore would you agree with us that we are not looking at the video for purposes of reviewing the suppression ruling?
I would agree that the video was not submitted, but I would disagree that this court shouldn't consider it. And the reason for that is it shouldn't be used. The lack of a video shouldn't be used to Mr. Juneau's detriment, because it was the state that was ordered to submit that video. Not once, not twice, not three times, but four times during the contested omnibus hearing. And so the state's failure to submit that video, I would argue, should not be used against Mr. Juneau. All of the parties intended this to be part of the record. They referred to it in the contested omnibus hearing. They didn't play it during the contested omnibus hearing, but it's clear that the parties expected the court to rely on it.
Why doesn't the language that Judge Johnson quoted at least create a concern about what a handler might testify to if called, which is the dog alerted on the vehicle and on the council? If asked, a follow-up might be, well, can you elaborate? And the handler might have said, well, yeah, the dog alerted on the vehicle, and then the dog entered the vehicle and alert it specifically on the console. Is that not at least a plausible interpretation, at least sufficient to foreclose the position that you're taking, which is that it's really impossible that any other facts might have been presented to have responded to the argument that you're raising on appeal?
Your Honor, I understand your interpretation. The language isn't on the vehicle and in the center console. It's on the vehicle specifically in the center console. It's a very small distinction there, but I think it does support the idea that this was an alert inside the car.
No, I understand that. I think you're correct. It does support that. My question, though, is might it support a different analysis if it had been elaborated on? If your client had pursued and been more specific as to the nature of the challenge now being raised on appeal?
Your Honor, I see how that's possible. And if that is where this court is leaning, if that's a big concern for this court, then I would ask for the second remedy that the state requested. And that's remand.
I'm just asking questions. I'm not necessarily staking out the court's position. I'm testing your theory. So you don't necessarily have to throw in the life preserver just yet. But yeah, you only have about 5 minutes left. So perhaps you should turn to your other argument that doesn't depend upon the forfeiture analysis.
Right. Before you do that, Mr. Nelson, one of the other factors, if we presume Watson is the test we should use, is the argument you make that the issue was implicitly considered or briefed in the district court. And what I'm not sure I follow how that can be, given the motion was the reasonable basis to do a dog sniff, and that's the argument and that's the basis that the court ruled. How could we assume that it seems very implicit, is I guess what I'm getting, so far from explicit to implicit, that whatever category might be below that, it simply wasn't argued in any way, it seems, to the district court. Wouldn't that be fatal as well?
Your Honor, just so I can better understand your question, it sounds a little bit like you're merging the raised prominently in briefing and closely akin to the arguments below. Which one are you specifically referring to?
They actually do sound a much similar, because the issue is not raised below, but certainly not implicitly argued. I think one of the points you make is that one of the factors is if it is implicitly argued and all the other factors are present, then therefore it's properly before this court.
So it sounds like this is more of a question on the closely akin. So it doesn't have to be implicitly raised. It just has to be similar. It can't be an issue that's coming out of left field. And so my argument here is that counsel argued the search was improperly requested. This argument is that the search was improperly executed, which is very similar. Identical isn't required. Also, I would point this court to the fact that the district court did analyze whether there was PC for a search, even though that wasn't something argued by defense counsel. So this issue about the search of the car is very similar. It's closely akin to the arguments below, and that's why I find that the third Watson factor is met.
Let me drill you down laser focus, since you don't have much time left on your reasonable suspicion argument. It seems like your brief is acknowledging that the officers had reason to suspect that the men inside the car were trying to hide something from police. Well, what do you suppose a reasonable officer might be assuming at that point or inferring as to the substance that's being hidden from police? Why aren't drugs the first thing that comes to mind?
Your Honor, I would agree with you that the slow roll stop and the furtive movements from Mr. Juno would support a reasonable suspicion that the defendant's hiding something. But what this court and what the Supreme Court has required is a reasonable suspicion of drug-related activity.
Now, the officer testified that the slow roll and hiding, taking time to hide something in the car, the officer testified specifically that it was sort of, in his experience, that it would be narcotics that would be hidden. Why isn't this enough? I'm wondering what else would be necessary? You have to know that you have to see the drugs. You have probable cause if you're at that point.
No, Your Honor. What the officer here needed was some objective indicator that what Mr. Juno was hiding was drugs, not a firearm, not something that's embarrassing that he just wants to hide from police. And so what would have satisfied that would be smelling narcotics, seeing drug paraphernalia, seeing some indicia of intoxication from Mr. Juno. Because at this point, the officer chose to detain Mr. Juno for 10 or 15 minutes while he brought in a drug dog. And if it's just as likely...
What about the officer's knowledge of the house where drug activity had been known to occur frequently in the past? Doesn't that supply the missing piece that you're talking about, which is concern about drugs in particular?
It does not, Your Honor. And the reason it does not is because Mr. Juneau didn't interact with that house in any way. And on cross-examination, Sergeant Blair actually testified that it wasn't suspicious, that it was not overly suspicious that Mr. Juneau drove past that house. And then he also testified that there were four squad cars parked on that road, and he would actually want motorists driving at speeds of 5 or 10 miles an hour to ensure officer safety. So the problem here is Juneau didn't go into the house, come out of the house, pull into the driveway, drop off a passenger. He just drove past that house like he drove past the other 35 houses on the street.
He drove past slowly, but you right?
Yes, he did.
But I mean, the fact that the officer noted slowly, that seems to indicate more slowly than otherwise expected.
So when I read the transcript, Your Honor, can I answer your question? I see I'm out of time.
Yes, certainly.
Sergeant Blair testified that he rolled slowly past 401 Sand Creek Drive and continued to roll on by. And so I read that as Mr. Juneau sees police parked on the street and does what we all do, slows down, rolls past the house, Sand Creek Drive, rolls past the other houses on the other side of the street, and then continues to roll on by. And so there's no indication he interacted with this house in any way. And because of that, I don't think the nature of that house can be used against Mr. Juneau. I see that I'm out of time. Unless this court has any other questions, I'll just conclude by asking this court to reverse and suppress the evidence against Mr. Juneau.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. You will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal, if you like. Counsel for the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, and I'm appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota as respondent in this matter. And I want to depart from my prepared remarks and just begin with what the court's primary concern was with the forfeiture analysis. This court should decline to analyze and adopt this brand new doctrine without sufficient briefing on it, without a sufficient record upon which it could even adjudicate the issue. So I want to step back and just look at what the lens is, the framework here that we're talking about. Appellant has conceded that this was an issue forfeited below. Appellant conceded in his reply brief that we are now dealing with a forfeited issue. What that means is that as a general rule, according to the Supreme Court precedent, is that courts will not hear or address those issues for the first time on appeal. So whether you're applying the Watson factors or whether you're applying the Sorensen line of cases, what we're dealing with is appellant is asking this court in its discretion to implement an exception to the well-ingrained rule. So that's the lens that we should look at whether we address this just as a general rule, but actually looking at whether this court has adequate briefing on the issue. I would suggest that it does not. What the court has before it is a few paragraphs saying that this is a novel issue in other jurisdictions that seems like it could apply here. Appellant did not affirmatively cite any case law for what that rule would look like in the state of Minnesota. Appellant did not affirmatively cite any case law for what the contours of that doctrine would look like. In fact, the only case that the court has before it that talks about the doctrine is a Sixth Circuit case that respondent cited to show that this is a murky, unstable doctrine that is wholly unclear how it would be applied in Minnesota. And so if this court were to entertain resolving what appellant is asking it to do, it would be creating a doctrine, it would be fabricating a doctrine out of whole cloth, and it should decline to do so without appropriate briefing. And before I address the record, I do want to just pause on that point because it's notable in the context that he's asking this court to adopt this doctrine. As your honors likely know, in this particular context of canine searches in Minnesota, the state of Minnesota has departed partially from how federal courts have analyzed canine searches. That's the State v. Wigan decision when the Supreme Court adopted that you need RAS, or reasonable articulable suspicion, to even have a canine search on the outside of a vehicle. It noted that in the federal case law that they are conflicting about how canine searches are applied. And so in essence, what appellant is asking this court to do is to adopt a body of case law that the Supreme Court has already departed from retroactively and apply it here in a case for the first time on appeal without a developed record. And turning to the idea of record, I just I don't know if this is a specific comment, but it's loosely what appellant stated on his principal argument. He cannot sufficiently speak to what the canine officer would have testified. That would be speculative. That forecloses consideration of the issue on appeal. The canine handler's testimony would have been the key testimony, even if this court entertained adoption of this doctrine. And again, looking at that Sixth Circuit decision, it said that in the federal case law, you see a general standard that amounts to this: absent police misconduct, the instinctive acts of trained canines do not violate the Fourth Amendment. That's more or less what the federal analysis is for these types of situations. And what appellant is saying here is saying, well, we have a video that shows a dog entered a car, therefore it's a Fourth Amendment violation. But that's not so. It's a fact-intensive analysis. In fact, there's three.
Can you address the Mr. Juneau's position that because it's the state that dropped the ball on getting the video into evidence, that what we might do is to infer a worst case scenario for the state, that the video, if we had received it, would indeed show that the dog just bolted into the car without doing anything that would suggest any kind of an alert or any interest in drugs, but just an interest in entering the car before he alerted onto the drugs.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I have 2 points to raise on that specifically. One is a clarification of what the record shows happened with the video. And second, I do want to substantively address the video. So first of all, I am not, or the state is not, opposing the court's consideration of the video. In fact, we introduced it as an exhibit on appeal. So we don't contest if the court considers it. In the interest of justice or as a supplementation to the record, the court has the authority to consider it. So the court need not, you know, go down this analysis. But procedurally, if you look at what happened at the contested omnibus hearing, the state did in fact agree to introduce the exhibit. But then what followed, if you look at the register of actions or the record on the trial level, is a number of continuances, both by the defendant and the state. And particularly what happened is that they entered into a tentative plea agreement. And so what happened was on, I believe it was November 22nd of 2017, there was a joint letter submitted to the court saying, we don't need a ruling on this omnibus issue because we have a plea. And then what followed for approximately the next year was the fallout from the failure to the plea because there were additional criminal charges added. And then on June 11th of 2018, the state filed a letter with the court asking for an updated briefing schedule, stating that he had a number of ongoing felony cases in Anoka County and the prosecutor wanted to know when the briefs were due and when the exhibits were due. Nothing came out from the court except for the court's order 2 months later on August 22nd of 2018. I only make that point to show that the state did not fail to introduce the exhibit. The state was asking the court essentially, when do you need the exhibit? By when do you need the exhibit? I just want to make that small clarification just to represent the record as I understand it on appeal. Now, substantively, to Your Honor's question about the video.
Mr. Young, I'm sorry, before you go on. So were there briefs previously submitted in the district court at the time of the hearing?
No, Your Honor.
So there's no briefing whatsoever on any of these issues?
That's my understanding.
Thank you.
And it was, whether it was just something that fell through the crack from court administration or whether the court didn't introduce a briefing schedule or there was a miscommunication, we don't know, but what we do know is that there was no briefing and no exhibit introduced. However, substantively, because I do think it's relevant, because again, the state's not opposing consideration if the court feels it's necessary in the interest of justice, is the video just doesn't get appellant to where he needs to be in order to raise this doctrine. What the video shows is that the canine unit entered the vehicle. That's uncontested. But what the video doesn't show is what would be necessary for this court to consider, to find, and to apply against the doctrine if it introduced it. And this goes to the hypothetical questions that all of your honors were asking opposing counsel. We don't know whether the dog entered the vehicle on its own initiative. The canine handler could testify to that. We don't know whether the officers have an affirmative duty to close the windows or whether the officers didn't intentionally or unintentionally close the door to enter the vehicle. We don't know when the canine alerted. Your honors keyed in on that specific language in the testimony. It does not say that the only alert was inside the vehicle. It is ambiguous at best and suggests that there might've been multiple alerts. Again, the canine handler would have been able to testify to that if this had been raised below or if this was properly brought before the judge for a contested omnibus hearing. And then finally,
I mean, it seems to me, and I not wanting to argue on behalf of the state, but it seems to me that knowing how dogs operate, it might be that the dog officially alerted in its training by barking or pointing or whatever. But yet there might be something short of an alert that would indicate that the dog nevertheless was aware of drugs in the car. And I guess for lack of a better way to put it, the dog had probable cause to believe there was drugs in the car, and that's why the dog went in. And the handler never was asked the question, why did the dog enter the car? It seems to me that's a problem.
I couldn't have said it better yourself, Your Honor. And that was actually the last point I was going to raise, is that we don't even know what the canine was trained to do. How it alerts, when it alerts, was it trained to sit if it alerts? Was it trained to follow its nose if it thinks that it, you know, has a trace inside the car? We just don't know any of that. And so this court just amply and simply does not have the record it would need in order to apply the doctrine.
Well, and can you go to the merits of reasonable suspicion then? I mean, we've got... it seems an acknowledgement by the appellant that there was some suspicion and that the suspicion is reasonable, but there's no reason to go from suspicion of something to suspicion sufficient to support a dog sniff, because it's got to be particularized to drugs.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I understand appellant's main position and the court's potential concern to be if it was particularized to narcotics, particularized to drugs, as you said. And I think actually Your Honor's hypothetical question, do we need officers to see the drugs, shows how it's almost unreasonable what appellant is arguing here, because there are multiple factors that did particularize the suspicion to narcotics behavior. So first and foremost, as I believe it was Judge Johnson's point of view or point that made on opposing argument, is that he was first observed suspiciously driving past a known narcotics house that, you know, for which officers had previously surveilled and for which Sergeant Blair himself had personal experience in making arrests. So we already have him in an area. We have the time of night. We're talking about 1:30 in the morning. We're talking about the night shift, and we see him suspiciously drive past the known narcotics house. Now, yes, some reasonable person might conclude, as appellant suggests, that he was trying to drive safely by the squad cars. But what Sergeant Blair thought in his 15 years of experience and the conclusions he drew is that this driver seemed to be a person who was headed to the house, but then saw the cars and then just continued driving past.
So, I mean, I don't know what there is in the record to support that inference. If a car is just driving in one direction, why shouldn't we be concerned about police using this procedure as sort of a dragnet? Like, we've got it. We know there's a drug house. What we'll do is we'll just post some squad cars there at 2 in the morning or 1:30 or whatever this was. I think it was 1:30. And we'll just wait, because people are going to drive by. And anybody who drives by slowly, we'll just make a connection. We'll find a reason to pull the car over, air freshener hanging in the windshield, as it was in this case, or some other taillight or whatever. Pull the car over and then use the fact that the car happened to be driving by this drug house as a basis for reasonable suspicion. Why shouldn't we be concerned about that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Your Honor, because on that hypothetical that you suggested, if you just set squad cars out as a dragnet, as you said, and you just see an infraction and you pull the car over and then you just request a canine search, I agree that would not be enough. Because that's not what the record here shows. There's also additional factors that Sergeant Blair observed and investigated before stopping the car. So first and foremost, he ran the registration of the car. He realized that it registered out to Buffalo, Minnesota. Now, again, that alone is not suspicious behavior, but you do now know that Sergeant Blair has a suspicion that this is not a neighbor. This is not someone heading home or leaving a house. Okay, he then follows the car. He observes the car do what he used, I believe the specific language is trying to distance the gap between him and the vehicle, driving a little faster, turning a little bit more than cars might otherwise do. So now you see continuing suspicious behavior. Sergeant Blair then turns on his emergency lights. That is then when you have the key factors that support RAS for the canine search. You see the slow roll of the vehicle. It doesn't stop immediately. And in fact, if you look at the video, you see it almost hops the curb as if he's driving distractively. And then the slow roll occurred for a long enough period of time that Sergeant Blair was able to use his spotlight to peer through the back window and At that point in time, he saw the furtive movements towards the center console. So if Your Honor is concerned about that dragnet potential, that just simply is not what happened here. And even if they did that, then you would still need those additional factors like what Sergeant Blair had.
Mr. Yount, are we limited to the three factors identified by the district court? Because, I mean, the question is whether, not whether there was sufficient suspicion for the stop, but for the dog sniff, which occurred later. And before the dog sniff, the officer recognized Mr. Juneau as someone he had previously dealt with. And I think, correct me or help me with the record, I mean, I think that he had previously encountered Mr. Juneau in drug-related matters. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, if the question is what would an objective officer do, may we as an appellate court rely on factors that are in the factual record that were not specifically cited by the district court?
Yes, Your Honor. What the district court cited in support of its order was the three most obvious or suspicious factors that you identified. And then I would just direct the court's attention to page 16 of our respondent's brief, because there that cites the black letter law. It says that appellate courts may independently review the facts and determine as a matter of law whether the district court erred in its ruling. So this court can go outside of the specific memorialized findings and look at the transcript from the credible witness and use those facts to support its Fourth Amendment analysis. And then just as a final point to what Your Honor just said there is that's the last factor that again, particularized it to narcotics. Sergeant Blair knew Mr. Juneau here from previous arrests and as being involved in the criminal drug world. In the PSI, it stated that Mr. Juneau had 5 separate felony cases ongoing in Anoka County. As a matter of public record, Mr. Juneau is facing a federal trial for possession with intent to distribute over 50 grams of methamphetamines. This is someone whom law enforcement knew to be involved in the drug world. And when he found that that was the individual whom he had been trailing and that was driving the car in question, that was the final factor that particularized it to suspicion of narcotics. And so unless the court has any further questions, respondent would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Your time has expired and it doesn't appear as if either of the other panel members has an additional question for you. So thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'm just going to focus on the reasonable suspicion. So counsel lists several factors. He goes into the record. He discusses the fact that Mr. Juneau's vehicle was registered from out of town, the fact that he was gaining distance on the officer, potentially speeding away from the officer. Counsel cites those as circumstances showing that this is somehow more likely a drug stop than a stop for guns or a stop for something Mr. Juneau's hiding that's embarrassing in his car. Those do not. None of the facts that counsel cited in his argument just now point to drug possession over gun possession or over possession of something embarrassing that Juneau is trying to hide. And that's really the problem with the reasonable suspicion analysis here, is that we have suspicion of something.
Bear in mind that the district court found the proximity to the drug house to be one of the factors considered. And if it's proximity to the drug house, I'm at a loss for why it isn't sufficient to make a connection. Again, we're not talking about reasonable suspicion. We're talking about a very low level of suspicion. And my mind always goes back to Terry when the case that brought us this theory of reasonable suspicion or this doctrine of reasonable suspicion. And as I recall that case, there wasn't a whole lot of particularized suspicion. It was that these guys were up to something. The officer wasn't sure what it was. In fact, he testified, wasn't quite sure what it was, but they were going back and forth and milling about and conferring with each other and then back and forth again. And that was enough for the district court to find reasonable, articulable suspicion that a criminal activity may be afoot. And why doesn't that line of thinking make it sufficiently clear that the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't require the type of particularized concern that you're regarding?
Your Honor, I have two responses to that. The first response is this is a different standard than Terry. This court and the Supreme Court in Wiegand and Davis have held that law enforcement officers need reasonable suspicion of drug-related criminal activity to conduct a canine sniff search. The reasoning behind that is sound. If you're going to detain a defendant for 10 or 15 minutes, you need to have a pretty good idea that it's drugs the dog is going to find, not something else, because otherwise calling the dog is pointless.
Well,
so that's my first.
Hold on. You said reasonable suspicion of drugs, not something else. And that's the problem I have with your argument, that reasonable suspicion somehow has to exclude the other reasonable potential criminal activity. And that's the part that I'm hung up on with your argument.
Judge Ross, I don't want to give you that impression, so I misspoke. What is required is reasonable suspicion of drug-related activity. The officer needs to have something that objectively points.
But your argument in your brief actually does make that point. Your argument in your brief is, well, it may be reasonable to think that there's something criminal going on, but you said, I think your argument goes, well, it's no more suspicious about guns than it is about drugs, indicating that there is reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, and it might be reasonable to believe there's guns, and it might be reasonable to believe that there's drugs, but one doesn't tip in favor of the other, therefore not reasonable suspicion. That's the problem I've got with your argument. Seems like you're asking us to exclude the possibility of other things.
Judge Ross, potentially that is a fair interpretation. My argument is that it needs to point to one more than another. If they are all equally likely, there is not reasonable suspicion of drug-related activity.
Is there case law to support that theory? It's an interesting one, but do you have support in the case law that it pointing to, if it's reasonable to suspect criminal activity, and it's reasonable to suspect that it's drugs, but reasonable to suspect something else as well, it has to be more likely drugs than some other criminal activity. Is there support for that?
Your Honor, I would just cite the plain language of Wiegand that says law enforcement officers need reasonable suspicion of drug-related criminal activity. The district court or the Supreme Court didn't have to specify drug-related criminal activity. They could have just said reasonable suspicion of activity, but they didn't. They chose to put a specifier on that. And so I would cite Wiegand for that proposition. The other point I wanted to make briefly is that Your Honor asked about the house, the slow roll past a known drug house, as being that particularized basis. My argument laid out in my brief is that is a clearly erroneous factual finding. Just because a particular house in the past has been known for drug activity does not render the entire street a high crime area.
Well, you refer in your brief to, you say it was a clear error because it wasn't a high crime neighborhood. But isn't it plausible that you could have a very specific high crime area around a house, even if the neighborhood is otherwise a law-abiding, peaceful place where there's virtually no crime? How broadly does area have to be construed for an officer to include that as part of the calculus of reasonable suspicion?
The line I would draw, Your Honor, is the property line. I would say this is really an objective geographical question. Did Mr. Juneau interact with that house, that property, 401 Sand Creek Drive, in any way? Or did he drive on the road just like everybody going up and down that road drives on the road? And so here, the district court's finding is clearly erroneous because the officer testified not only that this was a relatively quiet neighborhood, but also on cross-examination testified that it was not overly suspicious for a vehicle to drive slowly down that road. I see that
I have one more question if the presiding judge will allow.
Certainly.
And Mr. Nelson, do you have any rebuttal argument to Mr. Yount's argument in which he pointed to his brief that this court may consider factors other than the three factors identified by the district court?
I agree with counsel's recitation of the standard of review. If we're talking specifically about the officer recognizing Mr. Juneau, the one thing I want to clarify is what he testified to on page 16 is that Juneau was somebody he had dealt with in the past. So there isn't information presented to the district court that he knew him from the drug scene or he knew him based on drug arrests, just that he knew him. The other point I'd like to make is that the district court, I would argue, didn't include this finding because the timing doesn't seem right. What I mean by that is based on a slow stop and furtive movements and an air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror, this officer immediately approached Juneau's vehicle, put him in handcuffs, and put him in the back of a squad car. So my argument, and again, this is me speculating, is that the district court didn't include that conversation because he concluded that the officer planned on ordering the dog from the moment he took Juneau out of the car.
Ross, do you mind if I ask one additional question?
Sure thing.
It's the one question on a completely different subject, but I've been dying to hear your answer, Mr. Nelson, with regard to prosecutorial misconduct. Can you give me your best answer into how we reconcile the case law that says a judge, an attorney cannot give their own opinion on a credibility, yet an attorney can argue a credibility? And my point being, if we're using plain air, it's got to be clear and plain. How do you plainly distinguish how a prosecutor should do one versus the other? I understand your argument in this case, but I'll apply your answer to my analysis of your argument in this case, obviously.
I think the best way to distinguish, and I do think the prosecutor in this case did a good job of giving this court kind of two good comparisons. So there were times in closing argument where the prosecutor would say things like, Ives testified about this, he testified about this, and based on that, I would ask you to find that that's not reasonable. Versus, there are times where the prosecutor says things like, what is not speculative is that he is not telling you the truth. And there's a difference between saying, if you add these factors together, you should find that this is untrustworthy, or that it's hard to believe, it's a fanciful story. That's different than saying, this witness is lying, this witness is not credible.
Thank you.
Well, I see that I'm well out of time, so I'll just ask the court to suppress the evidence against Mr. Juno and reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Well, you're well out of time because we took you there asking questions that were helpful to us, and we appreciate your argument, Mr. Nelson and Mr. Yant, both of you. Your briefing was very thorough and helpful to the court, as well as your oral argument today, so thank you very much. The matter is submitted, and we take it under advisement. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.